Hello, the sun's out, possibly. The air conditioning's on in our fancy new studios, and we're back with another edition of Big Mouth, the Algonquin Roundtable of Music, Films and Telly. I'm Andrew Harrison, and I'm back from my holidays. Thank you, Sean Pattenden, for holding the fort with a one-woman show. Hello, Sean, how are you doing?
I'm well, thank you.
How was it? What have I missed in the past fortnight?
You missed Mick Houghton's amazing tales of rock and roll debauchery.
Okay, which I've got to listen to.
You must listen to it. It's very good. It's very jolly.
What else happened in the UK?
I think we're still in the UK. I think we're all holding it together. I don't think Scotland or Wales or Ireland have drifted off just yet, but they might do, might they? It's just chaos.
The only thing I saw that I missed was Noel Gallagher's done his interview again.
I refuse to read them anymore.
You don't need to.
You don't need to. You know what he's going to say.
Absolutely. We've got two guests this week. Movie critic Anna Smith is the chair of the film section of the UK Critics Circle. She's a regular on BBC News, Sky and The Guardian. She writes for Empire and Sight and Sound, and she's the host of the all-female movies podcast, Girls on Film. Hello, Anna. How are you doing? Welcome to Big Mouth.
Thank you. It's lovely to be here.
Now, be honest. Did you come up with the name Girls on Film first, and then think, that's going to be a podcast?
I came up with it in the early noughties, and my idea was for it to be something like a TV show. But then the podcast phenomenon happened, obviously, quite recently, and I thought, let's do it as a podcast.
So you invented podcasting by mistake.
I basically invented podcasting. You're welcome.
Tell us about it then. Tell us about the show.
So Girls on Film is a response to the need for more female film critics, or rather, the great ones that are out there having more of a voice. So the idea is we have two or three great critics in every episode, and we all discuss the latest releases and some classes from a female perspective, really. But we also get A-list guests in. I was actually really surprised by episode 3. Kerry Mulligan was asking to come on. We've had Brie Larson, Catherine Hahn, Maxine Peake, and we do live shows as well. So it's fun.
You've also had our favourites Beanie Feldstein and Caitlin Deaver from Booksmart on.
They were so lovely. I love those girls. They're fantastic.
Are they in character when they're not being the girls?
I would say their characters aren't too far off. And certainly Beanie, she's just so sweet and nice. She's actually got less of an edge to her, I think, than her character in Booksmart. She's just all-round cutie pie.
And you did one in Cannes as well.
Yeah, that was so much fun. So we like to go to film festivals and do live episodes there, and that was very much an industry audience. And quite a lot of men turned up. So actually we do have men listening to the show as well as women, which is always really lovely to hear from them. And one of the best compliments that I've heard, actually, I think Sanjeev Bhaskar said it to me, that it makes him think differently about film. So when men say that, I feel, great, we're doing our job.
Because there is a bit of an image of the film fan as a sweaty bloke in a Stanley Kubrick T-shirt, you know, with a Forbidden Planet bag. That's just me, obviously. Why don't women get a fair shout on the film critic thing?
It's a very good question. I mean, certainly in the critic circle, we've got a minority of women. We're trying to change that, and we're searching around and found some great people who are writing for magazines like Little White Lies. I think Twitter and the internet has actually made things more egalitarian, so we've got more women coming through and more people of colour, which is obviously another issue that is needed. But I think it's about making sure that people know that they're welcome, that it's not a boys' club, and for young women coming through to have an examples of the great female film critics to know that it's a job that they can do.
You've got a dark secret, which is used to edit the rave magazine Wax, home of drum and bass, etc. What were your greatest hits in those days? What were your grand achievements for Wax magazine?
Oh my gosh, well, I was the launch editor of Wax, and it was a kind of a very strange year and a half. It felt like about 6 years, but it was a year and a half. And I was the club's editor at Generator, and then we took, with the help of Mike Shallcross, who I think you know.
Friend of the podcast, yes. Mike Shallcross, yes.
We took the magazine to a medical publisher, of all places, and he bought it on a whim and just thought, you know, let's have a punt on this.
So because there's going to be loads of casualties as a result of this. Consequently, it'll be good for medical publishing.
Why didn't they call it A&E?
There you go. Good idea.
But we had all these kind of the great and good of dance music coming into this medical publishers and this wonderful culture clash. But, you know, I mean, we worked sort of 15-hour days. It was my life for ages. But then at the weekends, we got the run of all the clubs in the UK and beyond. So, you know, and we had Carl Cox and Sven Vath and Paul Oakenfold and everyone on the cover. So it was happy, crazy times.
Raving is amazing.
Also with us today is Big Mouth Regular. He's Britain's most mercilessly powerful music business journalist, a man whose pen can turn a top 10 into chapter 11. It's the author of The Final Days of EMI, the biggest thing to come out of Ballymena since Clodagh Rogers. Hello, Eamon Ford.
Hello. Yeah. And I'm delighted that there was no reference to U2 in my intro, which
you
was
wait.
Maybe
not.
Yes.
Speaking of the movies, we learn from Wikipedia that Ballymena Town Council banned Brokeback Mountain from being screened. Do you remember that?
I don't, but there was an amazing incident. I think, who had they banned? It was someone like ELO.
It was ELO Part 2.
Yes.
It wasn't even main ELO. It was the ELO Attic.
Yeah, which they believe were some kind of Satanists. It's incredible. Ballymena is, let's just say, trapped in time.
It's still trapped in time.
Yes.
Apparently, ELO Part 2 were going to attract the four Ds, said Balamina: drink, drugs, devil and debauchery.
That's all the things that Balamina needs.
Yeah.
They should have put that on the poster.
Yeah. Who should have been on in Balamina?
Well, who has played? There was a really famous little venue called the Flamingo, and people like the Stones played there in the 60s, and the Undertones in the 70s. So it was in those days, because it wasn't like you just played in Belfast and Derry. You went around all of the little towns. So you would play gigs basically in kind of little restaurants and cafes, really. Yeah. So they'd probably hold a couple of hundred people. And it was also tied to the peculiarly Irish thing of the show bands.
Right.
Which, if people don't know about the show bands, there's an amazing documentary on Netflix about the Miami show band massacre. And that's about it was a terrorist attack in the 70s. But it kind of puts the show bands in context, because international bands didn't really tour in Ireland. And so show bands kind of filled the gaps. And they were effectively kind of like those live Top of the Pops albums, where they would just play the hits of the day. And then obviously people like Joe Dolan and Dickie Walk and all of these people. I think if you're a Morrissey fan, you would have seen certain motifs in some of his live shows with people like Joe Dolan and things like that. But the show bands phenomenon is a very strange and really interesting part of Irish kind of popular culture. But what's the Miami show band massacre on Netflix?
You should write a book about it, Eamon.
I should.
Yeah, you should. You've been celebrating the cassette revival this week by saying the cassette revival is total nonsense.
It is.
Yes. Can you elaborate on this? Good old cassettes. Come on, Eamon.
Well, it's one of those things, and bless the music industry, for 14 years, the whole thing, the floor was falling out below everybody's feet, and all it was negative stories. Record companies are dead, nobody's buying music, and then suddenly they're kind of on the growth again. So they will wheel out these little good news stories. So vinyl's up. Amazing, 200% from not that big a base. So they went, hey, cassettes are back. And then you actually look at the numbers, and in the first half of this year, there was 36,000 cassettes sold. 4,000 of which were the Billie Eilish albums. So it's like, basically, it's a couple of big acts, put them out as a form of glorified merchandise, and they sell, and they go, oh my God, the cassette's back. But nobody plays it. And I think they said that cassettes made up 0.2% of record sales in the UK. So I wrote a piece saying that getting excited about the cassette revival was like IKEA getting excited about the return of Lino.
Don't like Lino, man.
Yeah.
Fair enough. What have we got on the show this week, Andrew?
Thanks for asking, Sean. First up, Once Upon a Time in Hollywood, in which Quentin Tarantino takes on the twilight of a certain kind of stardom at the end of the 1960s, as well as the Manson murders. Can you even touch such radioactive material without turning it into an exploitative kitschathon? And if you can, is Tarantino the one to do it? Plus, it's time for the memoirs of some shoegazing gentlemen. Ride are back with their second album since reconvening in 2017. Has Andy Bell got being in Oasis out of his system? And where does the feedback-washed Thames Valley sound of 1992 fit into today's over-hectic world? Plus, it's more or less half-time for 2019, so Anna is going to be talking us through her favourite films of the year so far. Remember, you can help us in our valuable work by supporting the show on Patreon, the crowdfunding platform. Pledge us the price of a pint, a mere £5 a month, and we'll send you every edition of Big Mouth a day early as soon as it's off the podcasting press. Plus the extra bit too, a little bit of additional Big Mouth to enliven your weekend. This week we're going to be choosing our favourite Tarantino movies. And if you pledge us the price of 2 pints, we'll send you an exquisite Big Mouth mug too, the thinking person's drinking receptacle. Search Patreon Big Mouth to find out a bit more. Anyway, let's start with Once Upon a Time in Hollywood, out next week. Quentin Tarantino's fictionalised and inevitably star-studded excursion to the end of the 1960s, the Manson family, and the last days of a certain kind of movie-making. It juggles fantasy characters, Leonardo DiCaprio's washed-up tough guy Rick Dalton and Brad Pitt as his stuntman wingman Cliff Booth, with real figures including Sharon Tate and Squeaky Frum, played by Margot Robbie and Dakota Fanning. Does it work? What's it trying to say? And should it be trying to say it? More for flavour than information, here is the trailer.
To my right is Bounty Law series lead and Jake Cahill himself, Rick Dalton. And to my left is Rick stunt double Cliff Booth.
So, Rick, explain to the audience exactly what it is a stunt double does.
Actors are required to do a lot of dangerous stuff. Cliff here is meant to help carry the load.
Is that how you describe your job, Cliff?
What, carrying his load? Yeah, it's about right.
Ha,
my hands are registered as lethal weapons. We get into a fight, I accidentally kill you, I go to jail.
Anybody accidentally kills anybody in a fight, they go to jail. It's called manslaughter.
That was the best acting I've ever seen in my whole life.
Like you.
Rip fucking dope.
Anna Smith, this is a long and sprawling evocation of the age that Tarantino clearly loves. What did you make of it as a movie as opposed to a grand sort of museum piece, love letter, here's all my favourite stuff?
Overall, I liked it a lot. I surprised myself by how much I did because I didn't have particularly high expectations from Tarantino with this one. I thought Brad Pitt is superb in one of the lead roles. There are some issues I have with it, but I still think it's actually Tarantino, it was one of his most sophisticated pieces of work. I think the dialogue direction and the acting really takes its time to build and really stays with you. I do feel it's overlong as a whole, but there were some scenes that I could have just watched for an hour, like particularly those including Brad Pitt.
He does like long movies, doesn't he? This is one of the one of those rare films where it's almost impossible to discuss the meaning of the movie without ruining the movie, as you'll know if and when you go to see it. But let's try anyway. He uses a mixture of kind of fantasy and reality, real characters, you know, newly created characters that were based on pre-existing individuals to try and do something different with that setting, but also the Manson murders, you know, as an event. And a huge part of it is you spend the whole film wondering what the hell is going to happen with this almost impossible to deal with subject. Without ruining it, can you give a flavour?
So there is a sense of sort of impending doom pervading the film. Very low level, because it is quite light in tone and it has his trademark humour a lot of the time. And it's a very starry show. But, of course, you are consciously thinking, as you say, what's going to happen? How are they going to deal with the murders? And I think however he would have dealt with it, it would have been problematic. Mm. And I think the way he deals with it is especially problematic. But I cannot say why.
I thought it was both problematic and genius. And for me, it's like the only way you can possibly do it. And again, if you see it, you'll probably understand why. But actually, it's not really a movie about the Manson murders. It's about that central buddy duo of Rick Dalton and Cliff Booth, the kind of the washed up star and the guy who's kind of at peace with just being his spare guy. They are basically Butch and Sundance finally getting a proper run out in Hollywood, aren't they? What did you make of that with Leonardo DiCaprio and Brad Pitt?
I thought they were terrific together. I think you're right, the Manson murders were just sort of in the background and sort of historical context in a way, but it really was a buddy movie about two men, one of whom is very dependent on the other. And it's about stardom, it's about fame. You know, Leonardo DiCaprio's character is intensely vain, he's an alcoholic, all the kind of issues that you understand go along with stardom. And then Brad Pitt's character very much in his shadow, losing his work, having sort of equilibrium by driving him around, basically, and where he perhaps is the real talent.
I think one of the reasons this chimed with me is because basically it's a film about old guys on the way down. And basically everybody at some point, every man has to confront the fact that he's an old guy on the way down. And it kind of struck a chord with me, particularly the way in which Leonardo, it's about Leonardo DiCaprio's inability to come to terms with the end of that kind of stardom and the fact that his place in the world has gone. But to me, it's like I nearly called him Quentin Valentino there, Freudian slip there. He kind of uses that as a template to say something about the counterculture, because I think this film was described somewhere as Quentin Tarantino's Make America Great Again. It's like a massive screed against filthy, dirty hippies and the kind of the awful counterculture, the hippies, basically, of the end of the 1960s. And the heroes are these kind of pre-hippie guys in their Hawaiian shirts. And so on.
Yeah, I wasn't desperately comfortable with that, having a small amount of hippie in me. There's a big rant at the end, which you know what I'm talking about, which I felt was a bit over the top. But what he did very well was create a sense of time and place. And you really did get the feeling of those two cultures clashing on the sunny streets of Hollywood, and just that feeling of the flirtation and between the two cultures in a way, because Brad Pitt's character has a flirtation with a hippie and you see them coming together, but that sort of sense of unease that he has with what she's doing. And of course she's a Manson follower, so that, there's good reason for that.
Amy, what did you think of it? You're a Tarantino fan.
I For the most part, yeah. And I like this because, obviously, he's kind of obsessed with a certain era of Hollywood, and particularly that flip into what we could call the kind of the end of that, I guess, kind of second era of the Hollywood studio system before it flips into New Hollywood. So you've kind of got Easy Rider and all of those kind of films are just about to start happening. Yeah. The power center in Hollywood and Hollywood's connection with youth culture is about to change. And there's a lot of that stuff that kind of going through the movie. And I love the attention to detail was phenomenal. You talked a lot about kind of the period piece in there and the sense of time and place. And there were little bits in that. There's a lot of driving in this film. And I find myself kind of looking through the window of the car saying, has he kind of missed something? And there were bits where he was driving for like 2 or 3 minutes. And all the street scenes looked exactly like they should look like in the late 60s. All the cars were period pieces. And I'm just wondering how much budget they had to close off entire streets, chunks of the freeway, to have not just, as you get sometimes in movies, three kind of period cars on rotation.
Yes, you see
it was
coming
like
and going.
Hundreds of cars from that era. And they dressed up Sunset Strip. They dressed up like that whole area around the Capitol building and stuff like that. And that was amazing. So, and I think obviously he's clearly obsessed with that era and that showed. And I think that maybe there was a little bit of over reverence to that period. I'm not sure. Maybe he kind of felt that. I don't know if he could kind of distance himself from that because he was clearly so interested in that era. But I think overall, there was a great piece, and it didn't feel like whatever it was, 2 hours 40 minutes. Yeah. It rattled along. It jumped between genres as well because there was lots of references to kind of old Hollywood in form of kind of westerns and TV westerns in particular, and it kind of jumped across that. So it was very much kind of Hollywood in transition, which I really liked.
That point about him sort of maybe being over being reverential towards, you know, the pre alternative Hollywood culture of, like, you know, real men who drink and drive their way around and all that kind of thing.
Yeah.
To me, that's kind of the point of the movie.
Oh, no, completely. It's a
piece against the over reverential treatment of, you know, basically the boomers, you know, the boomer culture of nothing had happened before the hippies and the hippies changed everything and made everything wonderful. I'm like, yeah, I am sick of the hippies. And I'm kind of on your side, Quentin Tarantino.
Well, they did pick the kind of 20 worst hippies
they
of
did,
all time.
Yeah, absolutely, 20 worst hippies of all time. Now, my challenge to you quickly is to, without ruining it,
give us
your take on what he does with the I can't call it the central thing, because it's not, the Manson Man is not really the central thing, but they're a huge element in the story. Is, you know, this is my challenge to you. Imagine you're on Just a Minute on Radio 4 or something.
No repetition,
and not, don't give anything away. Because you were not really sold.
I really, really loved it. And then there was a little moment in the last 20 minutes where it kind of flipped. And you're kind of thinking, right, okay, he's got these fictional characters running in parallel with real world characters. And then there was like one tiny little kink. There was an incident with someone having to go back to the car to get something. And you'll know what I mean. And I won't spoil anything. And I went, that didn't happen. And then it was kind of at that point I went, right, okay, it's kind of the narrative's kind of fractured, or this kind of this parallel or ghost narrative. And I kind of get why he did that. But I also felt that it was not a good way to go. This is really hard to talk about. When you've seen it, you'll know exactly what I mean.
And you'll know why. If Eamon doesn't like it, but you may also know what's like my favourite thing about the entire movie. Is this, Sean, what did you think?
I'm with Eamon on the ending that we can't talk about. It ruined it for me in a way. I was in the anticipating this movie. I do like a lot of Tarantino's stuff, but there's just this big but. I felt it just went in a different direction and it didn't need to do it. But enough said of that. It is beautifully made. I mean, apparently the budget was enormous. Apparently it's $95 million. Obviously we don't know. The attention to detail is wonderful, and there's a fantastic scene, and it is about manhood, it's about masculinity, it's about middle age, when Leonardo DiCaprio is sitting reading his book along with a child star of the terrible movie that he's just about to play a scene in, and he starts to cry talking about the plot of this book, and the child actress comes up, the actor, she calls herself, comes up to him and comforts him, And then there's a gag at the end of that. It's just so well played. And you see, he's so good at doing that. But I still think it's problematic regarding ladies. I think the female parts aren't realised. I think that's quite difficult to sit through 3 hours of that. Yeah. But even though I have a problem with the end, it's a good movie. I'd go and see it again.
I've got a way of talking about the ending without talking about the ending, mm-hmm. which is to do a parallel with Ira Levin, who's probably one of my favourite novelists. And the first 2 hours is akin, and there's a reference to this, obviously, is akin to Rosemary's Baby. And then the last kind of 20, 30 minutes is Son of Rosemary, his follow-up novel in the 90s. If you've read both of those, there's a kind of hint of why it's a disappointment and a kind of betrayal of the first book, and that's all I'll say.
Right. One thing I wanted to say is, if you have Sony Movies Channel, 10 films that inspired Tarantino are on from this week onwards. They're showing them, so if you've got something that can record them, because I'm very late at night, you'll see the inspiration for them, which I think would be quite rich.
I got the strong impression of this. I mean, I know a little bit about the world of that particular time and also the Manson murders, but I get the impression that there's so much packed into this. It's reference-packed.
Yeah.
Every little bit of it, all the locations have significance. Apparently, the booth in which the actors eat, the actors playing Sharon Tate and Jay Sebring, is the same booth where they ate the night. And it treads this kind of fine line between exploitation and treating it with some humanity. And I kind of think it pulls it off. To me, the surprise about it was, you know, Tarantino started out as this kind of, you know, enormously sort of, you know, flip and ironic individual for whom everything's style. And to me, this is a really humane movie, even towards the victims of the murders. It's kind
me
of
me and Eamon. We're shaking our heads a little bit there.
I'm somewhere in the middle there. But yeah, I'm with you, Sean, in terms of the female characters. But I never come to a Tarantino movie expecting it to be feminist. So it's one of those things you just sort of think,
well Chucky Brown, though.
Yeah.
Well, that's, you know, that's up for debate.
That's the exception that proves
I wouldn't
the rule,
call it necessarily a feminist film because it's from still written by Males' point of view. But yeah, I mean, I think it's an interesting film. It is very masculine. It is very male. I do think when he understands his characters really well and focuses on them, it's humane, but it's selectively humane. Mm.
That's true. But then he does work. He sort of ping-pongs between kitsch and reality, doesn't he? That's always been his entire thing. We haven't talked about the soundtrack, which is, of course, integral to all Tarantino's movies. And what I thought was interesting about this one is that it does two things. Firstly, the pop of the time is ridiculously optimistic and kind of two-dimensional. But the soundtrack elements that aren't pop, the ads and the jingles and all the rest of it, are oppressive and they're annoying. And they're almost saying there is something evil in the air here, something awful is happening in Los Angeles that the characters are not in any way intuiting, which I found really quite clever.
I love that. I love the fact that you don't see many films where ads come on when you're driving a car and they're on the radio and they're really, really loud. And you say that they're all for beauty products or aftershave or perfumes or things like that. It just, and there's ads and billboards everywhere. And there, as Amy's saying, there's a lot of driving. You see a lot of freeways. And that kind of coming in and that oppression with the Manson stuff as well, I thought that was really good.
On the music side, I love the fact that there was a kind of recurring Mamas and Papas motif all the way through. I don't know why that was, but anything involving the Mamas and Papas, I am here for this, as they say.
Don't they actually appear as one of the party scenes?
Michelle does, and then their music appears in
there.
And their music appears in different contexts as well. And I just, anything to do with the Mamas and Papas and that era of LA is just endlessly fascinating to me.
I think this is now my favourite Tarantino movie. I thought it had everything I like about him and nothing that I don't like about him in it. I am absolutely here for anything that knocks over the romanticisation of the Manson murders, anything that knocks over the idea that this was some kind of a rock and roll event that we should all go, yeah, man, that was great. You know, the sort of the helter-skelterisation of culture. I thought this was an absolute...
That book ended up with Alderman. That's the 60s dreams dead, man.
Yeah,
because it's a very neat narrative. It's the most tedious narrative.
It's enormously tedious. I thought this was a brilliant rebuttal of it. So what are we saying there? So I'm giving it three thumbs up with my two hands. Anna, you're sort of a bit more equivocal.
How many thumbs up are we on? Three?
Yeah, right. Like,
I gave it 4 out of 5 in Metro. How about that?
There you go. Absolutely. You're a bit more equivocal.
I am going to give it 2 thumbs up with the last 40 minutes of the top thumb chopped off in a horrible accident.
Very Tarantino, you chop your thumb off.
Kind of Tony Iommi style.
There you go. Stan?
I just say that I might go and see it again, even though I find it problematic, I might go and see it again for all the detail.
Before we move on, there's another music-connected movie out this week, and only Anna has seen it, Blinded by the Light, adapting the memoir of British-Asian journalist Sarfraz Manzoor and how Bruce Springsteen changed his life. Is it any good?
It's a lot of fun. So it's Gurinder Chadha, who made Bend It Like Beckham, and it's back to that very kind of mainstream, light, feel-good spirit. But, you know, I'm a fan of Bruce Springsteen. The music's fantastic. She managed to get permission to use it by sort of stalking him on the red carpet. I interviewed her for Girls on Film about it actually this week. She's tremendous. But you have to be prepared for it to be massively cheesy, but at the same time it really captures again a sense of time and place and spirit, and that idea of just being so overwhelmed by the discovery of a new artist when you're a certain age and you're a teenager feeling a bit awkward, and it literally changes your life, and it communicates that so beautifully.
How does it fit in with, you know, Yesterday and, you know, Bohemian Rhapsody and all these kind of, like, 70s rock feel-good is great. It's a feel-good movie.
It does seem to be a bit of a trend. I would say it's a bit better than Yesterday. It's a tighter script. It's a bit stronger. It's not as Richard Curtis, which I think is a good thing. I think if you've got an interest in music and an interest in feel-good movies, you should check it out.
Sounds like I would absolutely hate it.
What about people who have zero interest in Bruce, the area manager, Springsteen? Will this convince me to the cause?
I don't think it necessarily will, but I think that it will remind you of whatever artist is the equivalent for you. So whatever your obsession is, you will understand.
So it'll remind you of Sparks and Suede, Damon.
Okay, I am on board. This town is big enough for both of us.
Blinded by the Bert.
Right, that's enough wallowing in the past. Let's have some contemporary pop music. We always ask the guests to bring in a tune. Eamon Ford, what have you got for us today?
I have brought in the new single by the triptychly named Buzzard Buzzard Buzzard, who are from Welsh Wales, from Barry, I believe.
I believe you've raved about them before as well.
I have, and this new single, Love Forever, is fantastic. They're kind of, I wouldn't call them an ironic glam revival band, but they are tremendous, tremendous fun live. I believe I dragged Andrew Harrison to see them, and he had a Damascene moment and loves them as well. And I've only ever seen them play in tiny little venues, and they're basically just doing this incredible, ridiculous stadium show with just four kind of glam nerds from Wales, and they write very, very good pop songs.
Wonderful. Buzzard, Buzzard, Buzzard with Love Forever. Now, come back with us to the halcyon days of 1991. Fringes are a-fringing, feedback is a-feeding back, and the Thames Valley is alive to the introspective sound of the shoegaze. But how does that fit in with now? Ride are about to release This Is Not a Safe Place, their second album since getting back together in 2017. And with all of alternative music going wafty and unfocused, the time seems right. Can Mark Gardner, Andy Bell and the rest connect the shoegaze to the new gaze? Let's have a listen to one track. This is Repetition. Walloping drums, the four there, as befits a record produced, as was Ride's last one, by raving arch-druid Errol Alkan of Beyond the Wizard Sleeves fame. Eamon, did you have a shoegazing phase in a past life, I wonder? Did you like Ride?
I did like Ride. Those early EPs, kind of before the first album Nowhere came out, so stuff like Drive Blind and Chelsea Girl, I thought were really, really good. When Nowhere came out, I wasn't that fussed about the album. Those first couple of EPs were amazing. And then half of Gone Blank Again, I really liked. Obviously, oh my goodness, what's it called? Whose name I've completely forgotten. The really big single on that.
Leave Them All Behind.
Oh, yeah. Yeah, and Twisterella were reading it. And then, what was the album they did after that? Tarantula, which was just all went terribly, terribly wrong.
Mm-hmm.
And then with Weather Diaries, it was all right. But this one, I find half of it really good. I think when they kind of went for this really gritty, dirty sound rather than the wafty feedback thing. So the four songs that I picked out were R.I.D.E., Repetition, Kill Switch and Jump Jet were the four that kind of had a bit of grit I liked. Then they had a little kind of wafty bit, and that's all right. But I thought maybe, like, with that R.I.D.E. as the lead track on the album, we thought, wow, they're kind of doing something a bit different and a bit more experimental. And maybe they should have kind of leaned on that side a bit more. I think there was too much of a contrast, because suddenly you would have these tracks that had a lot of energy to them, and then it would go into a jangly or wishy-washy bit. And I felt that the kind of narrative arc, let's say, of the album kind of suffered. It was very stop-start, and I felt that if you're going to do this kind of beefier, kind of more experimental, kind of noisy stuff, just go for it. Just go all or nothing on that.
Yeah, I felt they may have had a piece of paper that said, remember the Sonic Cathedrals of Sound,
yes.
And then thought, yeah, this is what the fans like. Anna, what was your impression of This Is Not a Safe Place?
Well, yes, I mean, I was aware of Ride in the 90s, and, you know, I was more of a Stone Roses fan. I used to see them supporting people. They supported the bands that I enjoyed. But listening to this album, I have to say, I'm more with the jangly, wispy stuff. So I think you're absolutely right, Eamon, that it's kind of splits its sort of sound into two, really. And there's tracks like Future Love, which I really enjoyed, which were much more upbeat, I guess more commercial flavour, more melodic. And those are the ones that grabbed me. And the darker side is interesting. It is experimental, but it's not for me.
Right. Andrew Harrison.
Well, I would ordinarily avoid this like the plague, because I don't really... I mean, the sort of set text for this kind of music is My Bloody Valentine, and I don't like My Bloody Valentine. I sort of don't understand it. I find it sort of pointlessly abrasive. But I do like a lot of things inspired by My Bloody Valentine, like, you know, the Chemical Brothers and M83 and Beach House. The Chemical Brothers doing their My Bloody Valentine bit I like much more than actual My Bloody Valentine. That said, I was surprised how enjoyable this was. I think they're kind of, you know, it's you know, boringly better and more focused, and they're better at writing songs than they were. I think being in BDI and Oasis was clearly a bit of a journey for Andy Bell, where he perhaps realised what he's good at and what he likes doing, rather than being part of Noel's gang of Sherpas going up the same hill over and over again. I'm surprised how un-Errol Alkany it sounded. I've been expecting there to be a bit more, because I love Errol Alkany stuff is my stuff. You know, I love all you know, his kind of electronics, and Beyond the Wizard's Sleeve, not dissimilar from My Bloody Valentine, not dissimilar from, you know, taking the thing that I don't like and turning it into something that I do like. I was expecting a little bit more of that, actually. I thought I was going to get a record that sounded a bit like Temple's. And actually, what you get is a better sounding ride with better songs and a bit more beef and a bit more wallop in there. That said, it's never really going to be sort of central to my, essential iPhone playlist, do not delete XXX important AAA that sits at the top of the phone. But I was sort of pleasantly surprised by it. I mean, you can't, you know, I find it very hard to begrudge bands giving it their second go, having learned their lessons. Because I think they had a horrible, horrible breakup, didn't they?
Well, there is a track called 15 Minutes, which is particularly about being in a band for 2 years and then what do you do with your life? Did anyone, is there a Tarantino theme here? Some middle-aged men going... Oh.
I am here for middle-aged crises.
Yes. I think with Eamon, it's an album of two halves, and I like the sub-pop stuff. I like the stuff that sounds like My Bloody Valentine and a bit like Husker Du, and a bit, they're taking those influences. When it went into the Sonic Cathedrals wafty, that's when it lost me. It's like, I don't care about your girlfriend. Can you just get onto the dirty, grungy stuff?
You like the Husker Du, and I like the Husker Don't. That's what it is.
Repetition is a brilliant single. Bloody great. That's going to be on my new playlist.
Stop going on about Repetition.
But when are we going to get the Hurricane Number One revival, or the Hurricane Pound revival, as Select used to call it?
Yeah, Hurricane Number Two.
Sweet people, though. Anyone get the art dimension? You know, they like Rothko, they like their Jackson Pollocks. They like can we feel a bit of avant-garde coming in through Ride now?
I think it's less Rothko-y than it was. It's less splattery and impressionistic.
It made me go and listen to Lush, actually.
Did it really?
Last night. Yeah, I thought, well, I'll go a bit 4AD. Yeah.
Well, apparently, New Gaze is a real thing, wasn't it? There was a whole new-gazing explosion about 10 years ago of bands. That did, again,
what did Americans call it? Dream pop? Was there
Dream pop. Oh, yeah. That's lovely, isn't it? Yeah. It's a bit like K-pop.
Yeah.
Yeah, I suppose that's, it's actually shoegaze with songs, isn't it, dream pop?
Yeah.
Kind of, and the sort that kind of thing where people are sort of trying not to sing or trying not to sound like they're trying to sing. It's all it's quite circular and self-referential, isn't it? Yeah. You know what I liked? I liked their Beatle album, Carnival of Light, which they hated. I actually quite like that one because that's when they're trying to be the Rolling Stones.
Yeah.
Another band I can't stand.
That's quite an interesting feature. Albums that the actual bands hated but that are really good.
Yeah.
Yeah, that's a good idea.
Because they did, what's that, the track of that one, I don't know where it comes from, it's actually... It was clearly chasing the Oasis market of, oh, hello, you know, suddenly a bunch of 20-year-old Herberts have woken up to the Beatles. Let's supply some unwritten Beatles songs. And we're going to wear stripy blazers in the style of a Style Council Café Bleu cover because that's going to work for the audience.
But they've kind of been shunted to the side at creation because they were the pop band or they were the creation band that kind of had that potential to cross over. So kind of Mark Gardner with his little
kind
of fringe
looks,
and all of that sort. And they were written about in Smash Hits, and they were the band that were about to cross over, and then Oasis came along, and I think it wasn't quite there. Oh, and then the Beatles came along, and everybody was irrelevant. But like you read interviews with Mark Gardner and Andy Bell, and they kind of go, "Yeah, Oasis came along, and kind of the jig was up, really."
Knocked offside by the raw good looks of Gwigsy and Bell. There you go. Let's have some more music then. Anna Smith, what track have you brought in for the edification of the listeners?
I've gone for Iggy Pop's new single, James Bond, and obviously running with the movie theme. Not only is it typically very catchy and has his beautiful voice, but it's about she wants to be your James Bond. So this appealed to me, the idea of a female James Bond or a female James Bond attendant.
It was pretty ridiculous, wasn't it? The massive row kick-off the other day about there's going to be a female James Bond. No, there's going to be a female 007. It's not the same.
Exactly.
But people just got people... blokes and Celia Walden in the Telegraph grabbed onto it and said, this is awful, they're going to make her Jane Bond, ooh, you know, this is, you know, somehow ruining things for the movies.
Yeah, well, surprise you to learn, I get a lot of tweets about that sort of thing from angry men. And, you know,
a female writer who gets tweets from angry men, that's quite a novel thing in today's
world,
isn't it?
Straight, lunatic feminist, that's me apparently. Right. Whenever I do anything in The Guardian, I'm a lunatic feminist. But Lashana Lynch, who you referred to, came on Girls on Film as well, and she's absolutely brilliant. So I'm really pleased that she is going to be a 007 agent, not James Bond, let's calm down. But I just thought this was a fun nod in a way to the theme, and it's the sort of song that stays in your head. And it's got some quite quirky and amusing lyrics.
Well, I can imagine Iggy Pop sauntering through a Bond title sequence in his lingerie to this one.
I asked for James Bond, not James Bra. Get that out.
Yeah, think about it, yeah. Here's Iggy Pop with James Bond.
She wants to be your James Bond. She wants to be your James Bond. Well, it's not for a price, and it's not to be nice. She wants to be your James Bond. She wants to be your James Bond.
Finally, let's get back to the movies, not that we've been that far away from them. We're just past halfway mark of 2019, and we've got a film critic in the studio, so we thought it would be a good idea to have a half-term report on film 2019, as they would call it if Barry Norman was still around. Anna Smith has chosen her favourites so far, and we're going to talk about them after this taster, see if we can identify all five.
There's a family in our driveway.
It's probably the neighbours.
But y'all scared of a family?
Hi, can I help you?
Zora. Put your shoes on.
If you want to get crazy, we can get crazy.
Can I get the age before guys become dicks?
Oh, fuck! Yo, what the fuck?
Oh, shit.
You think you're pretty cool? Your ghetto ass friends.
A lot of the time, we feel like our lives are the worst. But I think if you looked at anybody else's closet, you wouldn't trade your shit for their shit. So let's go.
That's why we ride a
piece. Hey guys, it's Kayla back with another video. So, the topic of today's video is being yourself. Being yourself can be hard, and it's like, aren't I always being myself? And yeah, for sure. But being yourself is like not changing yourself to impress someone else. I don't talk a lot at school, but if people talk to me and stuff, they'd find out that I'm like really funny and cool and talkative.
By the way, I like your shirt a lot. It's like so cool.
What?
We have to go to a party tonight.
What?
Nobody knows that we are fun. We didn't party because we wanted to focus on school and get into good colleges.
And it worked.
But the irresponsible people who partied also got into those colleges.
I'm incredible at hand jobs, but I also got a 1560 on the SATs.
We haven't done anything. We haven't broken any rules.
Name one person whose life was so much better because they broke a couple of rules.
Picasso.
He broke art rules.
Rosa Parks.
Name another
Susan
one.
Susan B. Anthony.
God damn it.
Picture this. I'm a bag of... Put me to your lips.
Hand sanitizer.
Check.
Chapstick.
Check.
Mace. Listen, it is very important that you keep the safe... Christian says that you've got some special thing planned.
Yeah, it's like a crazy 9-day festival. It only happens every 90 years.
That was Jordan Peele's doppelganger family nightmare, Us, followed by a rich stream of coming-of-age movies. Mid-90s, the story of a troubled Los Angeles 13-year-old, a 13-year-old boy, splitting his time between skating losers and an awful home life. Then Eighth Grade, in which Elsie Fisher plays a congenitally awkward 13-year-old girl, trying and failing to fit in. Gucci. And then the brilliantly funny Booksmart, in which high school seniors Amy and Molly realise they've totally wasted their youth and embark on one last night of inevitable hilarious consequences. And finally, Midsommar, aka The Wicker Man Goes to the End of the Road Festival. We've covered all but one of these films, so that made me feel pretty good about our selection processes. Have we ascertained a character for the film of 2019 yet? Will they say it is the year of this?
Well, as you say, coming-of-age movies are figuring very highly here, and good quality horrors. I think both Us and Midsommar represent this kind of new wave of horror, which is very intelligent, really strong direction. It's the kind of film that you can go back to again and again, encourages repeat viewing. There's lots of Easter eggs. Also some quite strong female characters in both of those. So I think that's one side of it. And then you have this coming of age, all slightly different ages. But I was very impressed by Jonah Hill's directorial debut, mid-90s. When I interviewed him a while ago, he said that the best way to do something for the first time is just to go around and ask everyone else who's doing it really well. So he tapped up all his contacts in the film industry and asked them about directing and producing and writing. And he's put together a really personal kind of skater story, which I really enjoyed.
So let's roll back and sort of kind of do them in order. Let's go back to Us. I mean, it is great that we've got a black director taking a different view of horror, and you know, between this and Get Out, you see two really clever takes on a sort of a primal horror idea in the context of modern politics. Is it as good as Get Out, though, do you think?
I think it's better than Get Out. Mm-hmm. But people that love Get Out often think it's not. So I was kind of strong 4 out of 5 on Get Out, but I wasn't like, oh my gosh, it's the best thing ever. Us, I think, possibly has wider appeal. In a way, I think it is partly about race, but it's about many, many other things. And the night after I saw it, I lay awake literally listing all the things it's about, which is about 25 or more. And there's so many layers to unpeel, and I think it's so clever.
Unpeel,
so
see
funny.
What you did there.
So, yeah. but it's, yeah, really, really strong piece. And you can definitely watch it again and replay it. I think I actually replayed the film like scene for scene over in my head, and it encourages you to do that. It encourages a super nerdy, filmy attitude, but in a really mainstream, you know, big budget, let's get the crowds in format. And I'm really happy to see, you know, the horror fans, who are often typically sort of groups of teenagers, going to see something which has got a little bit of bite and thought behind it.
John, we did this as part of the show, didn't we?
We did, and I love Get Out. I am a big, big Get Out fan. I didn't think it quite had the tightness, you know, that Get Out has. Although I just love Jordan Peele, and I just think he should do a film a month. I can just go and see a film every month by him, because I think he's amazing, really, really talented. But you're right, there's a horror schlock thing. I don't think it's going to go away.
But I think he's got a great thing, which is to take a very kind of plausible social situation and then blindside it with something straight out of the Twilight Zone, something really a bizarre sci-fi horror stroke imaginative conceit that that not only kind of sets the horror in motion, but also makes you think about, why do I watch films? What am I getting out of this? This is just, you know, it's got something to say about the whole idea of filmmaking.
Yes, I mean, his references are numerous, but you don't need to be familiar with them for them to work, which I think is really interesting. And also, there's a wonderful sense of humour, which I think you're alluding to. You know, he's very darkly funny, and the shocks and the twists often create that typical horror laughter reaction, which is a mixture of fear and excitement and humour.
I like the way that he sort of sets up a genre and then smashes it to pieces, so you don't really know where you're going with it. Tell us a bit more about mid-90s then. Give us what's the plotline and setup here, apart from an unhappy 13-year-old? We've all been there.
So it's a young boy who's having trouble at home. He's being bullied by his brother. He sort of drifts along to the local kind of record skate shop, meets some older boys, mostly who kind of hang out, and he tries to be cool and get on with them and show off to them. They're kind of tearaways, but what's interesting is this film does not judge them. The mother comes in being disapproving, but they actually show that the boys have something of a bond, and one of the older, sort of more father figure type teenagers actually has a few quiet words with them and talks to them about showing emotions and masculinity. So a lot of this film is exploring fragile masculinity and communication between young boys who have been brought up not to talk about their feelings. And if that makes it sound preachy, then that's wrong, because it's also very funny. There's a big Dazed and Confused flavour to this, you know, sexual exploration and trying drugs for the first time and all this kind of thing. So it's very much the typical sort of 13-year-old movie. It's like Tearaway vibe, but I really liked it. I think it's definitely one to watch.
Eighth Grade was a massive hit on this show, and even you liked it as well, didn't you?
Yes, no, that was really good, because that kind of, obviously I'm not a 13-year-old girl, I never was, but just that kind of the, I guess, the boredom and the frustration of being that age, kind of waiting for your life to start and kind of watching everybody around you that you think is kind of getting their life together and you're not, and obviously her kind of whole family setup as well was really, really interesting, and it kind of felt not quite claustrophobic, but it really kind of captured that spirit of how brilliant and awful it is to be that age. I thought it was just wonderful, and I thought that she was just incredible actor as well. I thought just everything about it was brilliant. It was really heartfelt, it was really poignant, it was really funny. It had the whole emotional gamut. I loved it.
Anna and Sean, as actual former 13-year-old girls, did it speak your truth?
Definitely. I mean, like many people I know, I felt there were scenes of this that could have come right out of my life, like, you know, going to a swimming pool party and just being too embarrassed to actually get in the water, and, you know, and just wanting to speak to the cool boy but not knowing how to, and all these things which, you know, actually are kind of universal, whatever your gender. But yeah, it really, yeah, I felt it summed it up perfectly. And Bo Burnham, the director, who is a man, is the only man to date that we've ever had on Girls on Film, because I felt that here is the kind of exception we should be making, because he fully understood his character, his female character, and he decided to feature a young woman, because when he did his comedy routines, it was about being really anxious and having loads of social anxiety. It was mostly young girls of that age that came up to him and said they related to how he was feeling. So he wanted to write a film and very much use the experiences of his actress as well to inform the script.
Like Eighth Grade, Book Smart flips over the premise of the standard kind of John Hughes high school movie, because it turns out that the dicks aren't actually dicks, really, and that everybody's kind of got everybody's got their own road to hoe, and it's all kind of miserable in high school for everybody. I loved Booksmart. I think it is my favourite film of the year so far. Anna, tell us what you liked about it.
Well, it was incredibly refreshing, as you say, to see, you know, one's expectations being upturned with regards to all the different characters. But it's also an incredibly tight script and really strong comedy direction from Olivia Wilde. I mean, she's an actress. I mean, who knew what a fantastic director she'd be? So I think it's really exciting to see a woman be given that opportunity. I thought Kate Mendiva and Beanie Feldstein were terrific together. But all in all, it's just a really tight, well-made, funny film that doesn't drop the ball at any point, in my view. Stone cold classic, straight out.
And yet it didn't do that well. And worse than that, the kind of political right seemed to take glee in it not doing well. Ha, women, you made a film and it wasn't, you know, it wasn't as big as Endgame. Ha ha.
It did reasonably well, but I think it was possibly slightly in the States underpromoted. And that's maybe what you've got to look at sometimes, is like films starring boys and directed by men are given bigger marketing budgets. They're given more space. They might even be given more column inches sometimes. So there's a huge issue from the word go with female directed movies and female centered movies. But with films like this, I just hope that they will get more traction on home entertainment, which I think they will. And this deserves to be a cult classic. I think it will be.
Well, we've been doing our best to sort of, you know, it gets no more cult than this show, and we've been doing our best to sort of to push that one. Finally, we did Midsommar a couple of weeks ago, and we pretty much loved it. What's your take, Anna, on the Nordic Children of the Stones?
I agree with you. Yeah, I loved Midsommar. I thought it was wonderfully chilling and very funny, and had a lot to say about relationships and the kind of low level problems of again masculinity that it was exploring, really, on the long side. Once again, but I still felt that it gave so much, and I was absolutely hooked on every moment.
Do you think we should be worrying about long movies now in the age of novelistic television, where people are perfectly happy to invest, you know, 14 hours of their life in an episodic thing, and yet we complain when a movie's 2 hours. I haven't got time for a 2 minute long movie. Yeah, because I did not feel that. Once Upon a Time in Hollywood was in any way wasting my time, even though it's a good 2 hours and 40, isn't it? Something like that.
Well, that's the thing. I really say it's more of as a warning for the listeners, a reminder, just in case, you know, you're one of those people that needs to go for a fag break after an hour. But for me, it used its running time well, the same as Once Upon a Time in Hollywood.
Apparently there's a 4 hour cut of it as well.
The 4 hour cut of Midsommar?
Oh, no, I mean Once Upon a Time in Hollywood. It's a 4 hour cut going to come out.
I'd be up for either of them. Bring back the interval. Bring back the interval and the ice cream woman.
Yes.
And the advert for the curry house and the advert for the local cab company.
Yeah, you need the interval. The first time I went to an outdoor cinema in Greece in the 1990s, the only film that they had that was in English was Clueless. And we were watching it, and then just halfway through, in the middle of a scene, it just stopped.
But
and I thought that the projector broke it, and then just everybody unite for a gasper.
They have to change the reels in old films, obviously.
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
The change of the reels was lovely, yeah. You can do
but
something, put a new reel on, go back in.
To allow a lot of Greek man to basically power smoke 50 fags and then just come straight back in.
Digital projection has ruined another thing because you don't need to change. Maybe to change
the Gasper break.
Change
is not over,
or something like
that.
But
that would take you out of the mood with Midsommar, wouldn't it?
It would. Now, Midsommar. I watched it in a very sparsely attended theatre, and I have to say, it did not come across as a comedy at all. There were some sort of gasps of horrified laughter. But I think everybody saw it in a packed cinema that I know. So they're rolling in the aisles. It's hilarious. Why do you think that is? Because there are moments that are sort of objectively possibly funny.
I think it's that sense that it might be a bit wrong to laugh at certain things. Mm. And if it's teetering on the edge of being un-PC or of being too dark or mean-spirited, then you almost need a crowd around you to help you make the decision to push you into that laughter zone.
Yeah. If you're going to choose one of these five for your front runner at halftime 2019.
I'm going to go for Booksmart.
Yeah,
ooh.
I think I'm going to go for Booksmart as well.
I'm going for Midsommar, sorry.
Oh,
it's great. I'll tell you a hilarious story about Booksmart that you've never heard before, which was my girlfriend and I went to see it in the cinema on the hottest day of the year, and we went in and thinking it'll be lovely and cool in there, and the air conditioning broke, and the theatre manager came in halfway through and said, yeah, sorry about that, you guys are probably quite hot, and everybody was basically just melting. It was like the Nazis at the end of Indiana Jones. And then he said, do you want to go out and get your money back, or do you want to just continue watching? We'll give you free vouchers. And everybody was like, basically had just been Guantanamo'd through heat, and we're just going, just let this end, just finish the thing. So I need to watch it again without actually thinking that I'm going to be desiccated at the end.
Torture movie watching is the way forward.
And that's the end of the show, which means closing time chatter. What will our guests be discussing over a Bloody Mary at the Musso and Frank Grill with Rick Dalton and Cliff Booth? Anna.
So there's a survey this week from Kasumo.com about 1,000 people were surveyed to find out their favourite trilogies of all time. And it's very interesting to see what different age groups have voted for. So the baby boomers voted for The Godfather and Indiana Jones. Millennials and Generation X thought The Lord of the Rings was the best. And my favourite, Back to the Future, comes at number 8, which I'm very disappointed about.
Oh. Back to the Future.
They're all wrong. It's Star Wars. They're all wrong. It's obviously Star Wars. That's just mathematically
That's
proven.
At number 3. The Lord of the Rings comes out top overall. Then Pirates of the Caribbean, for goodness sake. And
I thought
then
that
Star
was
Wars.
Like an octology and it never ends. It just goes on and on and on and on.
Well, they're going 1 to 3 in brackets, so they're actually not not actually just choosing ones that end after three. So you can go like Indiana Jones 1 to 3, Jurassic Park, should you be so inclined, 1 to 3. Interesting for me, as Girls on Film host, we have no female-led trilogies here. I mean, you could have gone for Bridget Jones. You could have gone for Hunger Games.
You could have gone for Alien. Excuse me.
Good shout.
Which has got amazing Bechdel test bits. Get away from her, you bitch.
Why is that not even in here? That's a shocker.
Did Terminator
absolute
get in?
Shocker. Yes, Terminator is in there at number 9.
What about Jaws? Because it went Jaws 3D. Amazing.
Oh,
it was terrible.
Legendarily Jaws. Awful.
Oh, yeah, yeah, it was terrible.
What's your closing time chatter, Eamon?
My closing time chatter is I was reading a piece on the BBC website and it was a whole new education for me. Apparently, the use of the full stop in WhatsApp is rude. Mm. I didn't know this. So young people, apparently, they don't send long texts. They will send individual texts based on their individual thoughts, and so to throw in
a
full throw in a full stop is now considered rude because you don't use it. So if you throw in a full stop, that's kind of throwing cheer at everyone or trying to make a point. So kind of the full stop has been cancelled, which is
do you have a problem with this?
I do, because I think punctuation is an incredible thing. It's wonderful, and I it kind of got me thinking about the underused bits of punctuation. So there's a few that I kind of dug up. There's obviously the interrobang, which is the combination of the question mark and exclamation mark.
It's my favourite.
Then there was a thing that they tried to kind of impose in the 1500s called the percontation point, which was the reverse question mark, which denotes a rhetorical question.
We need that on the internet.
And then there is the irony mark, which was another field thing, which was a reverse question mark at the start of a sentence to imply irony. So in the same way in Spanish, where you've got the upside down question mark at the start of a sentence to show you that it's going to end as a question, or the upside down exclamation mark. So little things like that. I want to bring back the archaic punctuation.
But a share would say the emoji does that. The emojis are there to do irony, sarcasm, rhetoric.
But how do you know when...
As infantile
when person,
as they look, they're very clever.
Yeah, but when's this person... If you're in a text exchange, how do you know that person's not just going to keep gassing on unless you see the typing ellipsis thing?
I think this is why Jacob Rees-Mogg insisted on a full stop with two spaces after it, because he's trying to be rude. He's wanting Jacob Rees-Mogg Esquire with his... Also, I would much rather have a text finishing with a full stop than with a bloody cry laugh emoji, which is the plague of death.
With WhatsApp, no full stops. This is language is moving and fluid, and it's about the form.
Punctuation.
And it's about the context.
It's the framing device. But the worst thing, though, is people who do finish the sentence and then do a space and then do a full stop.
That's criminal.
I know.
That is a bit difficult.
You're listening to the Eat Sheets and Leaves podcast with me,
with some
Lynn
really
Truss.
Old people.
Yes. Well, my closing time chatter is a great piece I found on a great but depressing piece on Vox, the online writing site, about how the writer had found that that every small plate restaurant in America is using the same playlist: TV on the radio, LCD sound system, Phoenix Spoon, Yola Tango, Avalon by Roxy Music. She compiled this this ultimate,
brilliant,
slightly cool restaurant playlist. And the idea is that it's not actually a hip, it's the simulation of hip, it's the simulation of cool. Slightly noisy, a little bit left field, but very unobtrusive.
Elevator music.
Yeah, so they're not gonna play, you know, Guar at you, and they're not gonna play Drenge at you, anything that's going to drag your attention away. And it's like a modern incarnation of, do you remember the chill boom of 1999, where every hotel lobby in the world was playing Moby's Porcelain and variants thereof? So this is it. Studies say, according to this piece, peak music discovery occurs at age 24. By 30, nostalgia for past music overrides the hunger for new sounds.
Well, that's rubbish.
Well, it's a very depressing thought. That's studies
I just
say,
think it's
Sean.
Not true.
Studies show.
Who did the study?
Sorry, studies show me say. Them. Computer says at the age of 24.
A survey of 103 people
on the internet. Yes.
Who are all deaf. Yeah.
So basically, I think I want to compile a playlist for every small plate restaurant, and that will get the bloody plates moving. I'll tell you.
You do it. Andrew Harrison Enterprises. Yeah, absolutely.
What's your closing time chatter, Sean?
My closing time chatter is, you know, this no deal Brexit. You may not have heard of it. It's not in the news every day. Big unanswered questions for UK music. Of course. I mean, it's a bit obvious, but BBC News are highlighting the fact that bands just got no idea how they're going to tour. Touring's quite profitable and quite a good idea for bands. They go and they play their music live. They don't stream it. They play in front of an audience. what a good idea. No, but all this stuff. I mean, it's just going to go tits up, isn't it? No deal, Brexit and music. It just can't happen.
It's the carne, isn't it? It's the curse of the carne, where you've got to get insurance for every screw.
Well, no, but you have to list everything as you cross every border. So kind of British orders touring, if
you'd know a lot about this,
well,
Amy.
Well, if they kind of tour across kind of mainland Europe, all the stuff that they bring into those markets, they have to bring back out again, so they can actually have bought any equipment to avail of kind of tax dodges or anything like that. So you have to go through every border you cross, you have to go through and have checked, and you pay for this as well. And then when you leave, it's checked again. So it's like you've everything you brought in, you took out, and you didn't buy anything cheaper to bring out. When you're a touring band, that's a huge amount of equipment, and it's just another piece of admin for bands, which if you look at, are they going to have touring visas as well, which a British artist trying to tour in America is a nightmare, and whereas American artists touring here is very easy, but there's not a reciprocal kind of process there.
And
so
obviously,
it could just kill life.
It's going to take longer, so you can't do a date every night in different parts of Europe. You're going to have to do a date every... You know, bands, they don't get up in the morning. You know, drag these people out, and then you've got to spend all that time in customs. It's just another reason,
isn't it? Also, artists are touring less, are playing smaller European shows because they don't get the tour support from their labels. Mm. So instead of doing a 20-date European tour, if you're a development artist, you do a 6-date tour.
Yeah. It's a bad thing. Which brings us to the end of the show. Eamon Ford and Anna Smith, thank you for coming in. Anna, what are you looking out for next?
Oh, well, it's, you know, summer isn't the best time for movies. So I think September and the autumn, we're going to have some lovely Oscar contenders. And I'm doing Girls on Film live at the London Podcast Festival on the 12th of September.
Fabulous. Tickets available on the internet right now.
King's Place.
Of course, that's exciting.
That'll be exciting time.
Eamon, what's your next exciting piece you're writing?
I'm not writing anything exciting. Oh. I'm just writing more stuff about the music industry. I'm trying desperately to start another book, which I will tell you about later. But I've
is it called I Love You Too?
It is called I Love You Too, and it's an empty book that just has a massive swear word and possibly highly libelous stuff about Bono. Now, I'm supposed to be starting a second book, which I have to do by next Christmas. Which has got the cheery theme of death, and I will tell you more about that later. But that's what I'm trying to get started on. So I'm doing a lot of reading
about death. Right.
Eamon Ford's Dead Christmas.
And that's the end, cheerily, of the show. From me and Andrew, thank you for listening, and we'll see you next week.
Bye.
Bye.